Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate, and everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program. They said that, the quiet part, right? It's right here in this report from this fringe outfit called the Treasury Department that says we're on an unsustainable path. Mm-hmm. Now we have to talk about what that means. Hello, everyone. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity and Peak Financial Investing here with you again, back with Paul. Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Good to see you, Paul.
Good to see you as well, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Oh, likewise. Likewise. Great conversations we've been having, and I'm eager to continue this one today. So, you know, I care a lot about people being financially secure and well. As you know, during my COVID reporting, I found that a lot of people found that they did not have the ability to resist certain things because they didn't have financial freedom, right? They had to go to work. They had to get a paycheck. They've got kids in college, whatever the stories are, all complicated. But for people who didn't have the financial freedom to say no to certain things, they had to really put up with some things that were not ideal. You were declared an essential worker and sent out into situations maybe you didn't want to go into. Maybe you were forced to take the magic holy thing, which we now know was not very magic or holy, you know. And so all of that's coming out now. So financial freedom matters a lot. And, you know, Paul, I'm a big picture guy. There's some stuff coming that people need to know about, and I want them to know about it. And there's no easy answers to this stuff, but it's right there for us to see if we have the eyes for it. It's there for us if we can hear about it. So I just want to throw that out there. And by the way, this stuff comes to me through a really wacky, it's a fringe conspiracy site. It's called the U.S. Treasury Department. So,
be careful.
I've got some data there. So this is the data here. I've titled this Fiscal Unsustainability, and the subtitle is Who's Going to Eat the Losses? The financial report of the United States government for 2023 finally came out. I like to know what's going on. And so I read this thing. 255 pages of cheery joy, but let's start here. This is the nation by the numbers table that comes out of that report. And so it's just the, you know, it's a government's financial snapshot, big difference, and you know, just big picture stuff. And they're looking here at the difference between 2023, the year of the report, and comparing it to the prior year of 2022. And so net cost, gross cost of the government were, well, from they went from 7.42 trillion dollars, because this is in billions, and 1,000 billion is a trillion, so 7,420 billion is 7.42 trillion, to 7.6 trillion. They got some earned revenue, it's a thing, gain loss from changes in assumptions. They had some big assumptions the prior year. at any rate, they say here, yeah, I love assumptions, that 2.2 trillion in assumption changes. We'll get into that later some other time, not today. And then these are taxes. So we know what these are because we pay these ourselves. A lot of this is, and by the way, that 4.4 trillion is two different types of taxes. It's just income and corporate taxes, straight in, you know, straight taxes, but also FICA, Medicare, okay. Social Security, right? So that's total tax review. And then they said here, something that they called this year net operating cost was minus 3.4 trillion. And then there's this budget deficit, which we heard about, which was 1.695 or 1.7, rounding up 1.7 trillion. So that's the number they report. And they say, we had a $1.7 trillion deficit. But then the question is, well, what's that net operating cost? Well, I had to dig around in a bunch of footnotes, and I found out that's what they used to call accrual-based deficit, right? So you got a cash deficit and an accrual-based deficit for those who know accounting, right? Cash deficit's easy. Money in, money out, what's the diff? Accrual basis takes into account things like depreciation, unfunded liabilities that are coming forward. So from a household standpoint, like if I had children approaching college age, but I hadn't put money away yet, I could be recording that as a liability on an accrual basis if I was being honest with my family's finances. So that's what that is. I'm like, 3.4 trillion and the year before it was 4.1 trillion. What? So here they put it in a chart for us, which shows that year after year after year after year, the U.S. government is running somewhere between a $3 and $4 trillion actual deficit that bites at some point in time. $3 to $4 trillion. It's basically 100% of income on an accumulating basis. So
that's incredible. And they tried to do like the payroll report and add a little deception in there to make it harder to find, right?
Right. Right. Took some footnoting and some digging around, right? Mm-hmm. It used to be reported as an accrual-based deficit, which language I understood. So I'm still not entirely clear if they changed the methodology with the term. I bet they did. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take even more spelunking to figure it all out if necessary, but it's not. This is a train wreck. It's right there in black and white and so red and yellow and green in these bars. But I mean, it's right there. And I think people need to know about it.
Absolutely. Well, the impact that it's going to have on the individual from a tax standpoint, if we are forced to live within our budget at some point in the future, or a hyperinflationary standpoint, because they, you know, let me rephrase that. An inflationary standpoint, they try to pay it off through inflating away, which is a hidden tax. Or if there's just an ultimate collapse and default, you know, like mm-hmm. Soviet Union and other countries have done throughout the past, that's a massive impact on the citizens. It is. They have to be aware of it.
They have to. So just a couple more slides to round out this story. If this was a company, Paul, if this was my company, how would you advise me? I have total assets of 5.4 trillion, but I have total liabilities of 4.42.9 trillion. And by the way, this is just federal debt and interest payable of 26 trillion. We've all heard it's actually closer to 35. It is. They're not counting here in the liability side, Social Security or Medicare. The reason they don't count them as liabilities is they consider those to be changeable by law. The government can step in at some point and say, you know what? We're not paying those. Hmm. We've changed the rules. But they don't consider federal employee and veteran benefits to be changeable. So those are counted as a $14 trillion liability. Paul, I did not. When exactly did it happen that my government accumulated a $14 trillion liability to its own workers?
That's a really good question. Those pensions are really good for if you work for the government, though. I mean, they really are.
Must be. I missed that part. They do take care of themselves well. You will pass an ERISA Act of 1974, so you no longer have a defined pension. So you have to play in the 401 market. And mm-hmm. good luck. May the odds ever be in your favor. You know, but well, for us,
that's right. Well, and I would
gold
say
plated.
There's a little bit of pay to play in there too. If you think the way I do and you want to join the deep state here, we'll give you a good pension that's, you know, cost of living adjustment and, you know, oh, and by the way, we'll give you a big pay in the last couple of years if you play the game so that you've got this massive pension going into retirement.
Yeah. We've all heard about those, right? You just spike your last year or list, you know, last X months of income and then that becomes the reference point for all future payments. So,
yes. But yeah. you asked the question, if that was your company and you came to me and you said, what should I do with this, Chris? I'd say, well, Chris, go look at NVIDIA, go look at Coco and realize it's a bull market and find somebody out there that's going to ignore the data and buy that company from you and get out from under that liability now, ASAP. Yeah. Take advantage of the environment. Get out. Run as fast as you can.
All right. Well, that's. That alone, that company snapshot, bad, but it's not as bad as these charts got. So check out this next one. This is historical and current policy projections. So they take all the laws on the books as written, and then to make a guess as to what's going to happen in terms of receipts, right? And by the way, these projections, Paul, never include a recession, which tend to make the numbers get worse. So this just assumes. Yeah. No, this just
right happened after that.
Yeah.
In 2020.
Yeah, you know, these spikes, these never happen. It's just a smooth thing. But the way the laws are currently written, it says, and this is percent of GDP over here. So it says the government total spending is going to go from about 24% climbing all the way up. Total spending is going to get out here to 45 to 50%. You know, again, by 2100, but it's just, this is impossible. I mean, if the government could spend 50% of GDP and have it, things work, well, communism would have worked, right?
You know,
but this is shocking. The projections are, oh yeah, we're going to have, you know, government spending is just going to go up and up and up. And so here's what it looks like. Chart six. This one's lovely. Historical and current policy projections for debt held by the public. Debt held by the public is going to go from about a current 120%, 100%, 110% here to 500% of GDP. And look at this. Look at this line. Oh, my goodness. It's just a straight ride. It's just, oh.
Hmm.
Oh. And here's the money table. This is in trillions. So now we've just skipped billions. You know, most accounting statements are like in thousands and then millions, sometimes billions. This is the government. So we got to go to trillions now. And, you know, a few trillion here, a few trillion there. Eventually we're talking real money, right?
That's right.
So this says Social Security net expenditures have a net present value of minus 25 trillion. Medicare is another minus 50-ish trillion. Taken together, minus 78 trillion. Paul, this is a net present value number, meaning that for those numbers to pencil out, we would need 78 trillion in the bank.
Goodness.
Growing
gracious.
At the same rate as these liabilities are growing in order for this to pencil out to zero. And then there's also, oh, you know, 75-year fiscal gap is a percent of gross domestic product, 4.5%, but that's another 73 trillion. Taken together, there is $151 trillion of negative holes in the government balance sheet. And by the way, that leads to jokes like this. Hey, I heard a joke about Social Security, but you probably won't get it.
I've not seen that. That was a good meme. Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my goodness. Chris, it's incredible. Yeah. And could you imagine a presidential candidate actually talking about these numbers and people actually listening? That's a problem. You know,
yeah.
None of the politicians will discuss this. None of the media is going to discuss it. It's only the individuals like you that care deeply about this country and care about warning people and, you know, being prudent, foreseeing danger and while the simple pass on and suffer for it. And I don't see how there's any way we get out of this without massive pain. Right. The question is which pain are we going to take?
We'll talk about that in a second, but I want to follow on what you just said. It's not just people like us who care about it. I think we have some stealth allies in the Department of Justice, in their accounting department, because buried deep in this report, they had a headline, Unsustainable Fiscal Path, and they said here, an important purpose of the financial report prepared here is to help citizens understand current fiscal policy and the importance and magnitude of policy reforms necessary to make it sustainable. Down here in yellow, they said the projections based on the assumptions in this financial report indicate that current policy is not sustainable. They said that. The quiet part, right? It's right here in this report from this fringe outfit called the Treasury Department that says we're on an unsustainable path.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to talk about what that means. And that's where you and I come in, because my belief, and I could be wrong, Paul, I do not see a single political candidate who has the stones, the gravitas, the huevos necessary to step in and have an honest conversation about this, because it's an unpleasant conversation. So we're not going to have it.
Right.
We're just going to pretend like it's not a thing, but it's a thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a thing. And the sad part about it is it seems we've reached a point in the populace where there's enough out there that really don't care. Just give me what I can get today. I want to take from you, because you've had this class warfare that's been, you know, generated by the media to divide the people so the leaders can do whatever they want to do. You know, and when you were showing me those charts, all I could think of is, you know, the borrower is servant to the lender, right?
Mm.
Well, you got the government borrowing all this money and the American people owe a lot of it, but they don't seem to be serving us very well. They seem to be serving their own personal agendas. But yeah, I mean, at least somebody had the potential to say it. But the problem is you get one candidate that gets up there. Was it Ross Perot in the early 1990s, pulled out some spreadsheets and started talking, and, you know, people glassed over, and, you know, a lot of things he warned about have come true, but But if you have one candidate get up there and present this data, the other candidate's going to go, don't worry, I'll fix it in some magical way. You know, I'll give you everything you want. And then the American people aren't taking the time to really look at their own situation to vote wisely. I mean, we need it. I just wish there was a candidate that would step up there and actually follow through and start speaking. And hey, if you lose, you lose. But at least you've warned the people, because that's what we need.
Yeah. Well, what's fascinating is, Paul, that this speaks to that there's some kind of a great reset, you know, that has to happen, because unsustainable is unsustainable, right? You can limp along and pretend you're a going concern until such time as reality catches up and you are no longer a going concern. Right. That's what we're talking about here. I know it's unthinkable, but the idea that the federal government could potentially become not a going concern, it's a math certainty at this point, not even a math problem. It's just axiomatically true that on this trajectory, something breaks. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What do you mean break? Well, there aren't that many levers to pull. One, we have to spend below our means for a really long time, which means we take in a whole bunch of government money and we use it to pay down the debt instead of handing it back out to people during election seasons, right? Which is the traditional popular thing to do, right? We don't give out stimmy checks, you know, we don't send missiles we can't afford to foreign countries who are busy blowing themselves up or any of that.
Right.
We just pay this down, which is money going in with nothing apparently happening except our debts are going down. Like, I get it. It's not fun. It's a lot more fun, Paul, to whip out the credit card and get on a cruise line and, you know, have fun for a week. I totally understand that. But if you want to get your debt down, you do the opposite of that, right? And that would be the right thing to do. The other thing, so remember, I gave it away a little bit where I was like, well, they didn't really count in their liabilities, Social Security and Medicare. The government forces me to participate. There's no checkoff box. There's no like, no thanks. I'll invest my own FICA and Social Security money for myself. No chance. I'm paying into that system. But they don't count it as a liability because they know they can change the rules. So that's part of, they could change the rules, right?
They sure could. They could. And there's not much the populace can do about it, except for vote in the cycle. But the American populace is going to have to come together instead of being stuck on, you know, being political worshipers.
Well, this gets into a real generational issue, right? Because what we have then is eventually it's not going to be sort of, we cut stuff for retirees. We're going to say, hey, retirees, either you have to take a lot less and figure out how to eat cat food if you can even afford it. Have you bought cat food lately? It's pretty expensive.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I'm not sure that's a good analogy anymore. That's an old analogy, but
right.
you're going to have to eat bugs or something cheap.
Ramen noodles.
Or ramen noodles. Those are still cheap, right? Because I think those are made out of cardboard or something. I'm not clear.
They
sure do. Or we're going to have to ask the people who are currently working, the younger people, hey, we're going to have to double your Social Security tax. So these people who, by the way, made no hard decisions, ran up the tab, took the cruises, and now decided that oops, we forgot to do prudent planning. We need y'all to pay for it. And that's where it becomes a generational issue, because that's not fair.
No, it's not. Well, and two, the frustrating thing from that standpoint, most of the baby boomer generation didn't realize it until it was too late, the path that they're on, but they were given an inheritance and good fiscal responsibility from the generation that was before them. You know, and I see a lot of judgment in the baby boomer populace now. It's like, oh, the kids, you know, yeah, you're not buying a house because you're just not making the sacrifices that I was making back then. Well, your money bought a lot more in 1970, 1980 than what it does for the kids today. College was a lot less expensive. You know, baby boomers are buying up a lot of these properties, you know, and rents are a lot higher than what they used to be. So the barrier to entry to buying a home for the younger generations is a lot higher than it ever was for the baby boomers. And they're looking at that generation with judgment and saying, you know, you're not doing as good as us because you haven't been as disciplined as we have been. And that is not true. That's just not true. It was a lot easier for the baby boomer generation before than it is now. But I'm not so sure that they're going to get out of this unscathed, Chris. I really don't, because it, you know, something has to break at some point. So if we end up in a hyperinflationary holocaust, right? Currency collapse, yep. The government decides to print their way out of it. The rest of the world says, poof, we're done. The pain of using the dollar as a global reserve currency is too much. Y'all go do your own thing and blow yourself up. We're not going to continue to send you our manufactured and hard-earned goods and ship them over to you for your worthless dollars, right? So if that happens, then the baby boomers are going to lose everything through an inflationary holocaust anyway. Or if it's a collapse on the other side, you know, we have just a pure default on the debt on the other side of it, you know, they risk a substantial amount of pain. So I don't believe that the baby boomers are going to get out of this unscathed. I think they're whistling Dixie through the graveyard right now and about to walk into an open pit.
Well, this we have data, evidence. So the evidence is that every single time when the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve have just had to choose, am I going to protect the dollar or am I going to protect the bond market? They choose the bond market, which means that when necessary, they'll print up as much as necessary to make sure that they can buy those bonds and make sure there's a market for them. Because the government, I think this year, has a gross issuance already this year. I showed it in a thing. I found this on Lawrence Lepard's site. Anyway, the gross issuance of treasuries had already matched its height, Paul, that it hit during COVID at the worst of it all, right? So gross issuance is the new stuff plus the old stuff we have to roll over together. That's gross. And so $5.8 trillion of rollover this quarter.
This quarter. Yeah.
And so that means that bond market has to keep rolling. So they will do everything they have to do to keep that rolling. And so when you have gross issuance that you like, poof, you know, they're walking away, somebody's got to buy those. And so that's what I mean when I say what the government will print or the Federal Reserve will print in order to protect the bond market is because they have to make sure there's a market for bonds. As soon as they start openly being the market for government bonds, they're going to have to openly be the market for mortgage bonds and also corporate paper and maybe foreign bonds or maybe whatever. It's going to be, so that's printing. That's inflation.
And that's game over, right? That's game over. So, I mean, one thing we discovered during the COVID shutdowns, you know, that was a warning. I believe it was a birth pain for those of us who are watching and paying attention to what happened. I quite frankly had no clue just how finely tuned the global just-in-time inventory process was, right? But all of a sudden, you discover quickly, wow, we've got all kinds of backlogs and bottlenecks that are in the system. I get it because profitability is the most important, but we've sacrificed long-term sustainability as a country and individually our security net, right? So how many people, Chris, do you know out there that have 20 that are willing to take 24 months of their expenses and set that money aside for an emergency fund? Very few. Statistics tell us that less than 17% of the populace has even 6 months. I'm second guessing myself, but approximately 17%, because we did that presentation back at the Honey Badger event. You know, less than 6 months worth of expenses that they could cover from their own savings, selling assets, or borrowing from friends and family, right? So 30%, I think, was the total around 6 months. So, you know, we've got a society that we want everything that we can get today, and we're not making the sacrifices for the future. But yet, those of us who really look at life with our open eyes, as you get older, you become wiser. And I think a lot of the reasons people have midlife crisis in the 40s is they look and they realize, hey, had I made a few better decisions back then, I'd be in better position today. Right. And, but as a country, we're just not. And why are we spending this much money right now? Right. I mean, is it just strictly for political purposes? Because if the economy is that strong, why do we need to be this fiscally irresponsible right now? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Well, I think what people are also waking up to right now is that what the risks really are. I certainly am. So let me speak for myself. Paul, this past year, I learned that my justice system is not what I thought it was, right? And I, you know, somebody schooled me a long time ago. I was having this debate back in college and somebody, you know, I'm very middle sort of class, right? Just standard. We were just full middle class growing up. And so I was arguing about justice and this person brought me up short and they said, Chris, justice is such a middle class perception, meaning the rich know better and the poor know better, you know? And I was still found, I was clinging to a little of that, but then we watched these Trump decisions in New York where they charged him with fraud over something that nobody was harmed, and the alleged aggrieved party didn't even bring the claim and said, no, he paid us back. We're all cool. We would loan him more money, right? Like that, and then watching the various ways in which we've seen the weaponization of the Department of Justice and other, you know, district attorneys and things like that, that's been happening. In so much of our property laws, our wealth, how my wealth is protected within the system, Paul, depend on a functioning, timely, fairly adjudicated system of justice that you can fall back on. So I am having to recalculate that risk because it's a much bigger risk than I thought that this is going to be capricious, arbitrary, and possibly punitive, depending on political point of view or religious point of view.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And if you're not hitting the narrative that's coming out of Washington, then you're immediately, you know, guilty, you know, not innocence presumed, you're guilty until proven innocent instead of the other way around, which is the way it should be. And that's not justice. And that's been heartbreaking for me across the board. I mean, but it's in every aspect of our society. You know, I know somebody right now who had a minor fender bender. And car wasn't totaled, no major damage, but yet they're being carried to court for $1.8 million lawsuit because, you know, this person's hurt, right? Like the system's not standing up for justice. It's pushing some narrative and a lot of it's ripping the last bit of the foundation away from the middle class. And I'm shocked with what's taking place politically. I mean, you and I've talked about this before. I'm a political atheist. I'm not an atheist, but I'm a political atheist. I don't worship Democrats. I don't worship Republicans. I'm an equal opportunity basher of both sides, right? Because yeah, you are too. I'm an American. I care about the people that are around. It doesn't matter the color, the race, the origin. We're Americans, and when we're together, we have a good time, right? But they put out this perception that we're all warring against each other. That's just not the reality, especially in a small community like I live in. And, but, you know, just the lack of justice. I mean, how, if you're on the other side against Trump, even if you don't like him, right, you still have to stand for justice and truth and stand up against those double standards. And silence in an environment like this, when it's clear that there's a double standard across the board, is in agreement, you know, because if good people stand by and do nothing, there's absolutely no voice that'll keep us from descending into absolute hell compared to what our forefathers designed us to have here. And it's going to hit us financially. It's going to hit our families, and nobody's going to come out of it unscathed. Even those of us that are prepared for it, we're not going to be able to navigate it perfectly. The difference is coming out with a few scars versus not coming out of it at all.
Yeah. This is going to be such an incredible time to witness what's going to come down. A lot of things are going to change. I think protecting and preserving wealth through this period, Paul, is going to be one of the greater challenges. We're going to have to be nimble. We're going to have to challenge our core beliefs. We're going to have to try and understand a system that's largely opaque and resistant to being understood on purpose and by design, potentially. But none of that's an excuse to sort of sit back and go, oh, well, I guess that's just how it's going to be. Like, this is when we're going to really have to, you know, find out what we're made out of and really burrow down. And good news is, you know, you and I have been talking about the great taking as an idea set. I've extended that a lot further and gone deeper. And I know you and I have been having a lot of conversations. There are lots of things people can do to make sure that if you're fully exposed and ignorant over here, there's a lot of things you can do to be not that way over here. And it gets complicated. I can't give out specifics during this conversation because it depends on everybody's circumstance. Please talk with a qualified financial advisor. It matters. There's tax implications, there's legacy, you know, you name it, lots of complexities, but there are things we can do. And that's what I want to do. I just want to help people not accidentally lose what they've worked for. I think that's wrong.
Right.
For people to just ride in and create a fiddly system and abscond with people's wealth. That's or worse. It's getting, the battle lines are being drawn. Can I show you something real quick that I presented this to my So for people who are listening now, for my subscribers at Peak Prosperity, I have something called scouting reports. I deliver them every day. Okay. This is just a fragment of a scouting report. And I'm just finding stuff I think is important, but it provides important framing for where we are in the story as well. And it was this, Paul, which was that Rebecca Harnett wrote that finally, the Australian Senate finally said, you know what? We want a formal inquiry into all these excess deaths that are happening. So, and what's fascinating about this story to me is that the Australian Senate finally voted to establish this parliamentary inquiry into the nation's excess deaths, which we're seeing all across places that you know, for reasons I can't say here on YouTube, but we're seeing them in places that somewhere 21, 22 got some things happening. Here's the extraordinary part. So this took five motions by a senator, Ralph Babbitt, to get this done. Five. And finally they won. But you know how much they won by? One vote, 31-30. And the vote was strictly along party lines. Left-wing Labor Party and the Greens, oops, were 100% against just looking into what might be the cause of excess deaths that, by the way, have resulted in a minimum of 10,000 Australian lives being cut short. And that's a minimum because they also counted dying from or with COVID as a legit cause of that. But the difference between this column and this column adds up to 10,000 lives.
That's dramatic.
And it's the progressives. It's the left. Again, I used to be really apolitical, but this I can draw a line on, Paul. People who would vote against looking into why their own citizens are dying, these are people I now classify that they're... We're on different sides of the field in this particular story.
No, I agree with you on that. I shift to that's a side that I don't understand, because if you're not willing to bring something out of the darkness and into the light to examine it, and you don't love the truth enough to pursue the truth and have the courage to go forward, you know, what is it? Are they that selfish that they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want people thinking bad about me because I was against this and I was deceived. So what? If we make a mistake, you have to admit that mistake. You learn from the mistakes of the past, and you press on to the greater achievements of the future. That's the Optimist Creed, by the way. I like the Optimist organization. But anyway, so I'm with you. I have to draw a line with that too, because it just doesn't make sense to look into it and find out how we can be better for the future of our children and our family, because ultimately it wraps down to their individual families as well. And they would rather keep something in the dark to cover their own rear end potentially. But I don't think anybody at this point, you know, yes, I think there's people that should have capital punishment for what they did through that. But there are a lot of people that were just deceived in it. You know, just get it out here. Let's get it into the open. Let's figure out how to not ever end up in this situation again. That's horrific. But hey, kudos to that individual for fighting, because that should be something that opens the door of truth for the rest of the world. At least we have somebody that fought hard to get there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm hopeful, because, you know, now there's other things sort of erupting where we're starting to be able to finally ask questions. But this, again, so the whole COVID thing in this particular saga, and now also the cancer deaths that are now suddenly spiking all over the place, are actually, and because I think the Duchess, you know, they're in the UK, they're finally saying, hey, way too many young people are dying from cancer now. And regardless of the cause, we should be looking into it. And we haven't been looking into it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not worse than that. It's that there have been people blocking looking into it. And I don't understand that, right?
No, I don't either.
And I just don't. But now it's finally starting to come forward. And the parallel for me, though, Paul, is the same thing that you've been brave enough, and thank you so much for doing this and being willing to work with us, which is like, oh, there was some uncomfortable stuff that we learned about how the things got structured in the Great Taking. Fine. That's no reason not to look into it, you know, even though it could be complicated, even though it could work against, you know, your and my self-interest. It's like, no, it's the right thing to do. You have to look into it and figure out what we can do, because that's life. That's where that's we right. are, you know, just that's how right. it is.
And I'll tell you what, I wouldn't have it any other way, because we have to take our responsibility. Like, as a fee-only advisor, we're considered a fiduciary. So my responsibility as a fiduciary is to educate those that we serve over known dangers, right? I've spent 26 years working with retirees, and I've seen just about every situation that, that can be out there over that period of time. I know the potholes that are coming up around that the average person is going to face. We're going to help them sidestep those. So now, you know, and I will say, I understand why people just want to, in our industry, my industry, want to bury their head in the sand, because I looked at it a couple of times, and I'm like a pit bull with something when I grab hold of it. And I sat there and I just thought, oh my gosh, the amount of work that this is going to take to protect people. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, let's do it. We sat down as a team, said, let's figure out a way to do it. If we can do it, we're doing the right thing for people. And we're wearing that title as best that we can, as honest as we can, because, you know, my worldview is I've got to answer to a higher power at the end of my, when I'm done. Right. And I'm not a perfect person. Cut me off at a four-way stop and I don't wave with all five fingers. about the nicest way I can put that, you know, I've had to apologize several times before to people that I know. It's like, I tried to wave afterwards, but you cut me off. So, so I'm not a perfect person by any means, but, yeah. But if you keep that and you know that you've got an account and you live your life, like anything could, you know, if everything I did is on the cover of the paper, would I be embarrassed about that? If we all lived our lives that way, I know you do, Chris, you live your life that way. That's one thing that I've just been so impressed about you as I've gotten to know you over the years. So, you know, that's a responsibility. It's worth the work. And that's how we do our part in making a difference. That's how we do our part in one step. You know, Jordan Peterson was pointing out, you know, kind of some of the old historical biblical stories. If you just had 5,000 people across the country that were willing to step up and seriously educate people in their local communities and fight to point out the right path, that's enough to dramatically change the outcome of the country. Because as people get their eyes open, then they either have a choice to I do not want to hear the truth, or do something about it and give a better world to their kids and to those behind them. Even if they don't have kids, give it to the next generation that's behind you because you were given something that was good. Anytime I borrow something, I want to give it back in better shape than what I got it, if possible. So
absolutely. Absolutely. So let me just pull this chart back up. I have to switch back to the other presentation because I switched presentations. I've been hopping, but so I don't care which of these, you know, charts we pull up, they're all the same. They all say the same thing. So Paul, when I see that this is our path and that we have just year after year after year of $3 to $4 trillion deficits, knowing that there's going to be a recession, knowing there's going to be hard times, so some of these are going to really blow out to the upside. And just looking at a chart like this, which says that the expectation in the Washington crowd is we're just going to somehow expand our public debt to 500% of GDP. It's not going to happen, right? This breaks sooner or later, somewhere in this program, this whole thing just breaks. And that this chart alone, seeing that we have a net present value, which is a term, a financial term that means, what is the current today? What is the value of these assets plus or minus? And the answer is the United States has a net present value of about minus $150 trillion. That the U.S. Department of Treasury is calculating, I've seen other calculations by Rogoff go higher than this, doesn't matter. This is broke, a higher number's broke. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as broker. So, the question only is, it gets down to who's going to eat the losses. And I just want to, my bet is that they're going to print. They're going to print because that's the weak thing to do. And that's how I judge our current crop of leadership. So people, and probably future, people need to be ready that inflation we're experiencing now is going to get worse. And so how do you begin to protect against that? And I know you have one thing here, and I know we've got like 10 minutes before I know you got to go. So this is really disturbing. So we're talking about agents of chaos and darkness. Given all of that, a clear, obvious thing to do. I ended all of most of my COVID things with plant a garden. Mm-hmm. And that was me seeing that we were going to have these supply chain disruptions, and it's a good thing to do, and it would get people outside, and they'd be eating healthier food. But underneath that, Paul, I was worried about food availability going forward, because that's something that, listen, we can all live without a lot of things for a period of time, but food is not one of them. Mm-hmm. And now I see that in various states, most of them Democrat states, they are coming after small farms hard. Mm-hmm. like trying to shut them down with crazy rules, you know. They called some woman's farm in Oregon a concentrated feedlot operation, a CAFO, because she had 4 milking cows, right? And a CAFO is actually a place where they might bring 10,000 steer in and feed them up for a week, you know? And because she had a CAFO, a herd of 4, she wasn't allowed to use the groundwater, which was from the well that she'd been using for 12, 15 years or whatever. So if they can cut your water off, you can't farm anymore. But they're not going after the 10,000 cow operations. They're going after the lady with 4. In Maine, they're taking farms away because they have this contamination with something called a PFAS chemical, right? And they have these little tiny infinitesimal levels. And if you're above those levels, your farm can't farm anymore. And okay, we shouldn't have PFOS in there, but the government also of Maine had gave farmers sludge to spread on their fields that was loaded with these things.
So they give it to them.
They give it to them, and then you test their farm, and their farm can no longer legally can be a farm anymore.
Sounds like a setup to me.
It does. And so we've seen this pattern. And so we're actually watching this pattern of war against farmers in Europe. Mm-hmm. We've seen all the big protests, or maybe people didn't, but it's big and it's still going on. There are still farmers and tractors and no farmers, no food, right? Seems pretty simple. But I know you had something on farms that we looked at before, so maybe we close up with that.
I'll share that because I think that it's uploaded. But one of the things that I want to lay the background for here, Chris, is corporate profits are at an all-time high right now. When inflation originally starts out, that looks really good for corporate profits. Okay, but if this inflation continues, you know, and I've kind of postulated the theory, just not a serious theory right now, but I keep questioning, because we always have to take each step in investing with fear and trembling. And we have to know what we don't know, because we don't know how the future is going to pan out. I can look 7 years from now and I can tell you we're going to have a lot of pain 7 years from now. I just don't know how much longer they can kick this can down the road. So traditionally throughout history and all that I have studied, when you have that initial onset of the inflation that ultimately leads to a currency collapse, corporate profits get squeezed really hard. It happened back in 1973. We had a big 47% decline in the market. Now, corporate earnings continued to go up in 1973, 74 because of the inflationary impacts, but the market dropped because all of a sudden these companies had to, you know, let's say they didn't give their employees raises, right? But somebody in that Fortune 500 is going to go, hey, you know, I'm not losing employees. I can go poach a bunch over here. And then you start competing for that competition. So you've got salaries that go up. You've got input costs that go up. You've got the global disruption and the deglobalization that's taken place. And those profits get scrimped and you have a initial slam down in the market. Now, that may not be 60 or 70%. It should be. John Hussman does a really good job of pointing out, you know, fundamentally where we should get to. But what if that's 30 or 40 or 50%, right? Mm-hmm. How many people are going to remember 2000, 2008? They're going to panic. They don't have a good strategy. They're going to get out, you know, get out. All of a sudden, then the things that you want to have are not going up a lot in value, but the things that you have to have are going up a lot in value. And for those investors that don't react quickly, right, and have tools which can help them adapt, you know, they're going to be in trouble. Right? They're going to make some bad decisions. They're going to be too slow because what has worked for the past 15, 20 years or past 30 years is not going to work in that environment. And there's no conservative way to protect yourself against inflation. So I'll give a backdrop here and show the cocoa chart because I just got to show that. That's actually what started this. So I was like, you know, I came across this and then I came across the next chart. I'm like, okay, this is what we got to talk about today. So if I share or, you know, something that I'd like to at least share. So if I share my screen to begin with, let me get in my window here. That's it. Okay. Can you see that there, Chris?
Sure can. Yes.
All right. Yep. So this is a weekly chart of cocoa going back to, you know, April of 2015. Now, cocoa beans are the main ingredient in making chocolate. They're produced in tropical zones around the world, you know, mostly around the equator, but about 70% of the world's cocoa beans come from 4 West African countries, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Nigeria, Cameroon, and that source of that statistic. Without getting into all the details, there's issues in the Ivory Coast. But when we look at this right here, I mean, all of a sudden, you've had this massive increase in in the cocoa prices that going back to October of 2022, October of 2022, you're up, what is that? I've got my contacts in, 378%, something like that. So that's a sheer upward move. Now, I wouldn't be surprised. I think I stopped sharing. There you are.
Yep.
If when we get the inflationary event that we see that happen in commodities and other areas, mostly because we're just-in-time inventory across most of our farms around the country. So what this is from an article, I think I've got the disclosure on there, over 140,000 farms lost in 5 years, in the last 5 years. So this goes back to 1950 in the first chart. So since 1950, the number of farm operations has declined 3.75 million acres, or 66.4%.
Wow.
The number of acres farmed, has declined by 323 million, which is 26.9%, slightly less than twice the size of Texas. Now, yes, we've had technological advances. Yes, we've had, those have helped feed conversion ratios and extra production and land. But the problem is, during that period of time, what the U.S. populace from 1950, we were, let's see here, what's that number? 159 million, 1950, we're 340 million in 2023. During that same window, the global population has tripled from 2.5 billion to 8 billion. Okay, so yep. You know as well as I know, you always reach the point of diminishing returns when it comes to efficiency. So you've had corporations that have entered, you've had regulations that have gotten in here. Most of your farmers are still making less than what they were 30 years ago, right?
Yep.
So this figure talks about the change in the number of farms. So you've had some, the largest increase was in Hawaii. Next, you've got Iowa up here. That's really in the mainland. You've got a couple in Rhode Island, New Jersey, and Maryland. But that's a dramatic reduction in the number of farms, 17,000 less farms in Texas. And what is that? 7,300 in California, just to put it in perspective. So, this is a dramatic reduction. Yes, we've got extra efficiency, but what happens if we, if deglobalization continues and we have to continue to produce within the United States? So this is a percentage reduction in farms across the board.
Wow.
So that
includes acreage. So acreage, number of farms, obviously. So small farms are getting wiped out. We're going to the ag model, big yes. ag.
Yes.
But also number of acres is down.
Yes, the number of acres is down. So,
wow.
Yeah, the number of acres operations has declined 3.75 million. The number of acres farmed declined by 323 million, or 26.9%.
I might not mind that too much, Paul, if that was it was left fallow and so it's still good farmland, but it needs to be left fallow. But I bet a lot of that got paved over or built on or otherwise repurposed into the suburban experiment and strip malls and things like that. I wonder how much of that's just gone.
That's a good question. He didn't go into all of that inside the article. But, he did just point out that, percent change in area operated. So, yep. Texas lost a lot of farms, but you only had about -1.2% in area operated. You go up there to Oregon, you've got 5%. But, the concern is, my concern is you look at if we're going to end up inflationary from this standpoint, I want to show one other, chart that I have showed before. But the reality of this is, let me go in here. Bear with me just a second. I got to find the right chart list. I'm trying to save you from having to go through all of that. And for whatever reason, on the wrong ones.
Well, while you're pulling that up, it was interesting on that prior chart. A lot of those states with red that had lost a lot of acreage, those were blue states, right? I saw Maine, I saw New York, I saw Oregon. Those are places where farmers are having real trouble because we got these busybody people coming in wanting to legislate the heck out of those farms until they put them out of business. I don't know why they hate farms so much. Possibly because farmers have an authentic connection to something and these people hate that. I think, it's a guess.
I don't know. I don't understand that there's got to be some, they're deceived in some manner, because if they actually sat down and thought about it, a lot of times I'll talk to people, especially, friends, or just think through what we talked about for the next couple of days and then let's revisit it. So we're not into sometimes I just don't think they take the time to think about it.
Yeah.
So the one thing I want to show you here, and this is what's unique. Now, first off, this is not a recommendation. This is just an observation, because I'll tell you right now, we are not overweighting commodities in this environment. We did, you know, kind of late 2020, but we had some signals that told us in 2022 that we needed to, you know, take our profits and go somewhere else. But what this is a chart of the major indexes from 2008 till today. So the black line is the S&P 500 index. The blue line is GNX, which is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. The red line is MSCI EAFE, which is developed markets. And then you've got emerging markets. So here we are since January 1st of 2008. We're 16 years later. The U.S. markets, now I don't have the NASDAQ here. NASDAQ performance is a little bit better than S&P, but it gives you an indication that the U.S. markets have garnered all of the assets at the expense of commodities, emerging markets, developed markets. Now, that's one that's unsustainable from a long-term standpoint. We just don't know when that's going to change. But if you're one of these big U.S. companies in the S&P 500, man, money has been flowing to you like crazy. If you want to offer stock, it's no problem. If you want to put bonds out there, it's no problem. Money's become easy. And if we go back to that, you know, good times create weak men and women, you know, you've got businesses that can be complacent in managing. You take these other companies in the commodity industry and emerging markets. If you're Latin America, I mean, you've had to be lean and mean and paying attention, disciplined in everything you do, because you have to fight 100 times harder for the money that's out there. Now, we saw that happen from 1990 to the year 2000 as well. Now, these charts don't go all the way back on a daily basis, but it gives you a good representation of the U.S. markets outperform. Now, the dollar has been strong for the past 10 years, relatively speaking. The dollar was strong in the 1990s. But you take a potential currency crisis or an inflationary event on top of an asset class that has been dramatically underperformed and overlooked for the past 16 years. And at some point, it may be 2 or 3 years from now, maybe 4 years from now, I'm not advocating going out and getting it right now. You got to talk to an advisor. I'm just making an observation of where opportunity might be. But this is 2000 to 2007. So 2000, 2007, that black line is the S&P 500 went sideways for 7 years. Commodities, yeah, they started to take off. They took a hit during the 2001-2002 recession. Technology bubble burst. Emerging markets got cratered. That was the worst performing asset class if you get down there to end of October of 2001. But in that 7 year period, when you had a reversion to the mean and investors woke up and says, you know, we probably shouldn't have been chasing all those technology stocks in the late 1990s. And then you had this reversion to the mean. So my point here is, you know, I talk about that just to bring up, there's opportunity out there for the investors that are flexible, that are focused on the long-term picture, and they're patient, and they're not worried about keeping up with the Joneses, you know, next door from the standpoint, because if we look at where the ball's gonna be, we don't, you know, you don't overweight a category until it gives you some indication that it's taken there, at least from our perspective, because we've got tools that tell us, okay, now the momentum is there. Now this is the time that you take, you know, good, strong positions in this category. So thank goodness that I haven't been, you know, overweighting the, you know, emerging markets and commodities since 2014. Our tools have kept us out of that area. But my point is, this is such an extreme opportunity from a long-term standpoint that investors need to, you know, be having conversations with financial professionals about how you can take advantage of that, especially if we get the inflationary outcome that I just don't see. You know, now I still think we're going to have a deflationary event before we get that inflationary holocaust. We may not, you know, that's why I've asked the question. Are we going to look back 3 years from now and say these were early signs of hyperinflation? I don't know. We don't have enough information to act on that yet. That's speculation. We don't speculate. We invest. Mm-hmm. And hope is not an investment strategy. I had to say that.
Yes. Yes, you did. Well, I'm going to make a case that maybe we're looking at an inflationary outcome, because this is the German DAX again, and German economy is absolutely sucking wind here, doing terrible. And it's just been nothing but a straight ride, gapping up even at times, just off to the races day after day. It's very coincident with our own markets here. I think we can see here today, the S&P same thing. It's just ruler straight. These are things that would be more consistent with an inflationary outcome. That's the only way I can really explain that. I can't explain somebody saying, I have to have the German market right now at any cost.
No.
Unless you were worried about that that was probably the best use for your money because you're worried that your money was going to be worth less going forward. And so you wanted to at least own an asset class that somewhat keeps pace and trots along with inflation. And you had big money. Because let's be clear, big money, Paul, big money can't go into farms. Big money can't go into gold. Big money can't do the things. That's a good thing about being a smaller investor is that we have, we can actually, you know, duck around a little bit. I don't know what I would do if I was, you know, not Norway. If Norway said, Chris, what should our sovereign wealth fund do? I'd be like, I don't know.
Right. All the reports. I mean, you know, when you think about that, and that's one of the things that I point out to investors and clients is tops are a process. And the reason tops are a process and bottoms are an event is it takes time for the big money to create the media euphoria and the belief that you're missing out on all this so that they can sell to you. They can't do it overnight. It takes 6, 9, 12, 24 months for them to get out because they're playing the long game. You on an individual level, if you've got less than $100 million in a particular, you know, in most of the stocks that are out there, you can sell everything that you've got, you know, $100 million worth of most publicly traded stocks, not all, don't hold me to that. This is just kind of generally speaking. And one trigger, you might hit the price of percent, right? But if you've got 100 million, may do more than that. But if you're billions, if you're a lot more than that in today's environment, it takes time. And you have to generate enough public demand from the individual person through convincing you that there's fear of missing out so that they can offload their shares to you. That's the reason why tops are a process, and that's the reason why it's typically the most euphoric at the top. Now, you go look at some of the insider transactions that are taking place right now. We've had a lot of relative – now, are they huge parts of their holding? No, but it coincides with prior market peaks in the past where they're reducing their positions, you know, because there's enough demand out there right now to do it. So the point being is, look – our tools are saying the path of least resistance is higher on the market right now. And I'm, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see a correction. I expect the market to go higher into midsummer, but we have all the signs under the surface that, that we are in a topping process. You know, so we have to act accordingly. We just got to invest with fear and trembling at this point, play the game as the rules are forced upon us, but have one foot close to the exit so that you're not, you know, so that you have a chance to get out the door once the building starts burning.
Absolutely. Well said. Paul, I know you have to get on with your next appointment here. Thank you so much for your time today. We've been talking with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. If you want to have an amazing interview and discussion with Paul about your personal financial circumstances, please come to peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple form. Emails get kicked out. You'll be notified and called back and then start the process. So with that, Paul, thank you so much for your time again.
My honor, Chris. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too. Hello, Chris Martinson. I'm the CEO of Peak Prosperity and also Peak Financial Investing. And after watching that, you're probably wondering, well, what do I do with my money? Look, you both deserve and need somebody who can talk to you about what's really going on in this world, understand the situation as it is, not be steering you towards certain things that don't make sense for you or just keep you in a game that's already ended. Look, if you want to talk to somebody about the petrodollar declining or what is happening with gold or which sectors are actually the best ones to be in, given what the Federal Reserve is up to or the federal government, you deserve to talk to somebody who can answer those and has a few gray hairs and has been there through some of the economic cycles because, hey, we're in another economic cycle, so it's good to have that experience. Fortunately, at Peak Financial Investing, what we do is we go out and we scour and we look for the very best firms out there who satisfy one thing above all else. They've got great experience coupled to great customer service. So if you want to come by peakfinancialinvesting.com, there's a very simple form you can fill out, just a few fields, you hit send. What happens is an email gets triggered out. It goes to an endorsed firm of ours. You will get an email back. You can then set up a phone call for a 30 to 45 minute free, no obligation, no pressure call to find out if this firm is a good fit for you and to find out if you're a good fit for the firm. It has to go both ways. And if all that matches up, this will be one of the best things that could happen to you this year. So please come by peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple process. We would love to help you if we can. Thanks very much.